Tonight, before we really get into talking about antitrust, which is the last 3 weeks, I wanted to touch upon some of the main points in the whole the Austrian theory of competition and monopoly that are made by Murray Rothbard and Israel Kirzner. And the one article by Kirzner that I put on the syllabus is representative of Kirzner's thinking on entrepreneurship. He's written so many of them, and many of them are repetitive, and they essentially say the same thing. But they're sort of applied to different contexts. This particular one was addressed to the issue of economic development, economic growth. But he makes basically the same general points about entrepreneurship that he made in a lot of other places. And so I could have chosen a lot of articles, but our method is to only pick two or three per week and not have this an overwhelming PhD level course necessarily, because we have a mixed group of students. But in terms of the substance, I think one of the first points that Rothbard makes in this chapter on monopoly and competition has to do with a dispute he had with a fellow traveler of the Austrian school, William H. Hutt, who was really a great labor economist and a friend of the Austrians. And so I don't look at him as sort of an adversary necessarily of Rothbard. They just had a disagreement on this one thing about consumer sovereignty. And to give you an idea of why it wasn't really a decisive disagreement between the two economists, they were friendly and compatible on most things. One of my favorite quotes from Human Action by von Mises is on page 270 of the Scholar's Edition. It's about consumer sovereignty. And here's what Mises said. He said, "The consumers patronize those shops in which they can buy what they want at the cheapest price. Their buying and their abstention from buying decides who should own and run the plants and the land. They make poor people rich and rich people poor. They determine precisely what should be produced, in what quality, and in what quantities. They are merciless, egoistic bosses, full of whims and fancies, changeable and unpredictable. For them, nothing counts other than their own self-satisfaction. They do not care a whit for past merit and vested interests. If something is offered to them that they like better or that is cheaper, they desert their old purveyors. In their capacity as buyers and consumers, they are hard-hearted and callous without consideration for other people." And that's the consumer. And that's just his description of the consumer. And this, in the context here, is von Mises is making a point that on the outside, a lot of people think that who really controls the free market economy are the bankers who lend the money and the corporate executives who run the corporations and who make the decisions about production and pricing and so forth. But ultimately, it's the consumer that is in charge in a free market economy, because the bankers, when they lend money, the number one criterion is, will you pay it back? And whether or not a business will pay it back depends entirely on the consumer, pleasing the consumer. And the same with the every decision that every business manager makes. If he pleases the consumers well enough, he'll make profit and he'll be able to pay back the loan and he'll thrive. And so so don't think that Austrians or Rothbard in particular disavow the idea or the concept of consumer sovereignty. But in terms of applying it to the study of monopoly, that's where the difference is. The study of the monopoly model and the competition model is where Rothbard had a dispute here with William H. Hutt. And if you wanted to read anything about Hutt, by the way, he wrote a book on the economics of racial discrimination in the 50s called The Color Bar. And he was teaching in South Africa, and he was a real lone wolf. He was an anti-apartheid academic in South Africa back in the 1950s and 60s. But getting back to the main point that Rothbard makes here is that in the monopoly model in economics, monopolies are said to restrict output below what would exist if there was competition, and I'll address that in a minute. And as a result of that output restriction, there's said to be a loss of consumer surplus and producer surplus, for that matter, if it's not a constant cost industry. And so there's a loss of consumer surplus or consumer welfare, consumer well-being, because of this output restriction. And that is said to be a social cost, a cost to society. And that is used in the standard model to rationalize or justify government regulation of markets to supposedly force businesses to produce more, to produce the optimal level in the name of enhancing consumer well-being. And the simple, straightforward point that Rothbard makes is that he argues that we should look more at individual sovereignty and not consumer sovereignty, because what you're doing when you focus only on the consumer side of the market here with consumer sovereignty is you are implicitly saying that property rights are not really that important after all, and that that business person who is deemed to have restricted output, whatever that means, his rights to his property or her rights to her property are not sacrosanct, and the government should come in there and intervene and force him to do something against his will or take over his business or break up his business. Those are the types of things the antitrust regulators do. And Rothbard's point is that there's no reason to believe that consumers should have superior rights in society over the businesses who sell them the products. Why should government policy be based on infringing upon the rightfully owned, legally owned, peacefully acquired property of business owners in the name of this thing called consumer sovereignty? So it's one thing to recognize that the consumers really are in charge in guiding what gets produced and so forth in a market economy. But as applied to the issue of competition and monopoly, it's a very different issue. And this comes from Rothbard's always keeping a focus on property rights and especially natural rights, his natural rights approach to just about everything that he wrote about. And so there are important implications for property rights in any kind of antitrust or anti-monopoly regulation, because if you're in favor of a government regulation of mergers in any way, for example, you really are saying you're not in favor of property rights of business owners, even if that property was legally and peacefully acquired and has caused no one any harm. And so that's point number one. Point number two has to do with this whole idea of output restriction in the monopoly model that I assume most or all of you have seen somewhere along the line in terms of a textbook exposition of this, and that there's really no way of knowing in the real world what the optimal level of output in any industry is, other than knowing that the people who produce the output pursue their own self-interest as best they can to try to maximize their own economic well-being. They coordinate their plans with the buyers of their products, and whatever output the free market gives us is pretty much by definition the optimal output. And the blackboard diagram of monopoly is really just an artificial construct that has no basis in reality. It's a blackboard or a textbook construct. And so, no one knows, no central planner, no economist knows what the optimal number of Toyotas is today, what the optimal number of refrigerators is, for example, and whether or not the existing production level is below that optimal number or above that number. There's no way of really knowing that. And of course, when you buy into this idea that it's really at the center of the monopoly model, output restriction, we must avoid output restriction at all costs, it's odd that it comes from economists, because it really implicitly assumes that there is no scarcity. Because in a world of scarcity, meaning we have unlimited wants but limited means to achieve those wants at any one point in time, therefore we must make choices. When we choose one path, there's always an opportunity cost of whatever it is we gave up. And that's true everywhere. It's true of the economic world. And so when you say that their output is restricted, it's really a red herring argument, because all output is restricted beyond, below what would exist if there was no scarcity in the world. And so this model of monopoly really implicitly assumes that if you had a magical world with no scarcity and perfect information, here's the nirvana out here, and we would reach this nirvana or utopian level of output. And of course, the real world always falls short of that, because there's scarcity in the real world, and we don't have that. I think I said last 2 weeks ago at the first class, I mentioned an example of this where a Federal Trade Commission economist was giving a presentation at a conference I was at and was bragging that they were going after car dealers in Detroit who were closing up in the wintertime at 5 p.m. and they were thinking of forcing them to stay open until 9 p.m. Well, Rothbard addresses that issue in this chapter sort of in an inverse way. You might recall that at this conference, I said I asked this Federal Trade Commission bureaucrat, does that mean that forced labor is necessary for economic efficiency? And he didn't know what to say because the obvious answer is yes. And Rothbard alludes to the same point, the same phenomena in this chapter, that when you go down this road of thinking that the benchmark for a monopoly or competition should be output restriction below some sort of utopian ideal, then the policy solution becomes forced labor of some kind. You have to force people to work more. And why is that a moral thing? Why is servitude a moral or socially beneficial thing? Is the question that Rothbard asks. Okay. Well, another point that Rothbard makes that Hayek doesn't really get into at all in the article, in Hayek's great article, The Meaning of Competition, is dealing with the whole issue of collusion. Hayek doesn't really deal with that in that article, although he deals with a lot of other things, mergers, price cutting, and so forth. But on the issue of collusion or the creation of cartels, I think the most important point here is that when you think about it, a corporation is one big act of collusion, if you will, and that is a loaded term because cooperation is really a term that can describe the same type of behavior where individuals who participate in a corporation, they cooperate with one another and they don't cooperate with another corporation. They compete against other corporations. So in a sense, yeah, they're colluding. You can say that they're colluding to produce a product in competition with other groups that are also colluding together to produce products. But there really is not much of a difference between that and maybe two or three companies who get together and collude, if you will, or cooperate to try to produce a product. And a good example of what Rothbard is talking about here is comparing the difference between Japanese industry and American industry, where with the Japanese car industry, for example, pick anyone, Nissan, Mitsubishi, Toyota, they're all giant conglomerations of manufacturers, automobile parts suppliers, insurance companies, finance companies. And some of them, I think I read at one point, Mitsubishi, there were more than 300 different companies that made up Mitsubishi Enterprises. And all of that would have been illegal for many, many years in the United States. It still would be, I believe, be illegal because it would be collusion. But no, I mean, the Japanese automobile market is very competitive. They can provide competition all over the world. With Toyotas and Nissans and Mitsubishis and all the and Mazdas and all the rest, but they are organized in a collusive way under the type of rhetoric that we use in the United States in the antitrust area, and so that's why, for example, in the 1980s, at the beginning of the 1980s, I can recall when we were still in a recession in 81, 82. Even very liberal economists, the name Lester Thoreau comes to mind. He's a former dean of the management school at MIT. He, even though he was a big liberal, one of the most notorious liberals in the economics profession, he advocated the complete abolition of antitrust laws because he was quite the expert in Japanese industry. He traveled over there quite a bit, and he saw that all of this cooperation that we would call collusion and was the root of their success, of why the Japanese automakers were so successful in the United States and elsewhere. But we have this thinking that collusion is to be stopped at all times. And Rothbard was onto that. I think he explained it very nicely there. Another thing that Rothbard touches upon that Hayek did not is the efficient size of firms. And for a long time, there's been a huge literature in in economics on the efficient scale of firms. And I can't tell you how many excruciatingly boring papers I was forced to read in graduate school and that I've seen on the agendas of professional meetings with titles like Economies of Scale in the Cement Industry, where people would spend years doing statistical work on trying to pinpoint the right scale, the efficient scale or size of the cement industry or the nail industry or the plywood industry or whatever. And the idea here is sort of pretentious that some economist who has no stake in the business can somehow decide how big an industry ought to be, and then perhaps advise the government on that, and then have the government look at that industry, and if that economist says the industry should be bigger, what is the government supposed to do? Is it supposed to create a new government-run company to compete, as Obama has recommended, with health care? Or if the economist says it's too small, or too big, rather, are we to put some of the companies out of business? And this sort of mischief has gone on for a long time. But as Rothbard points out, the only way to know with any degree of, I won't say certainty, but reasonable reliability of what the efficient or optimal scale of an industry is to allow entrepreneurs to figure it out for themselves, allow the people who have a financial stake in it, whose careers are based on it, who have the inside knowledge of the industry, and who have every motivation and every incentive to produce at the most efficient scale possible, because that gives them the maximum profits possible. And that's the most reliable way of finding out whatever the most efficient or optimal scale or size of an industry is, not to have some outside economist or central planner or Federal Trade Commission bureaucrat guess based on some mathematical model that they might work out. And so so that's another argument against government tinkering in the size and scope of industry, to leave alone this idea that the government can centrally plan the efficient scale of industry. After all, the Soviets tried to do that with their steel and other heavy industries for many years. Why on earth would we want to entertain that idea? Rothbard also talks about a number of different types of so-called barriers to entry that really weren't discussed much by Hayek, and one of them is capital requirements. This is not as important a thing today as it was 50 years ago, when we were still sort of close to the machine age, and entering a major industry meant building a factory. Today, entering major industries is more information-based. It's more hiring lots of highly skilled and highly educated engineers is more the type of capital investment that's really important today, much more so than brain rather than brawn, as it was 50 years ago. But this argument is still around that supposedly to enter an industry, it requires a lot of money, a major industry. If you want to compete with Microsoft, you're going to have to come up with a lot of money to compete with Microsoft. But that doesn't explain, however, how Microsoft came about to get the money in the first place to capitalize itself. Because after all, IBM was the king of the hill in the 1970s. There was a lot. In fact, the federal government sued IBM under the antitrust laws for 13 years. It was in court for 13 years, and finally, I believe it was 1983, the government finally gave up on the IBM antitrust lawsuit because the judge in the case died. And of course, a new judge would have had to gotten himself up to speed in 13 years of litigation and many boatloads of files and papers and so forth. And the U.S. Justice Department Antitrust Division just said, oh, the hell with it, and thing disappeared. And so you had this colossus, IBM, and you had Bill Gates and a few of his buddies that came up with a good enough product or products that they were able to come up with the capital. Another interesting story is CNN, the television network. Ted Turner is the entrepreneur who founded CNN, and when he founded CNN, he couldn't find none of the big investment banks would lend him money. As I recall at the time, he wanted $1 billion, and all he had was a business plan for all day news. This was back before there were these channels that had news on all day long, and in America we only had the big three networks for many years, who were just getting into the cable era at that time. And the banks all told Ted Turner, "You're crazy. No one wants to watch news all day long. 1 hour around dinner time is enough." And so he did find another entrepreneur named Michael Milken, who worked for an investment bank that was willing to put together investors to capitalize CNN by selling high-risk, high-yield bonds, because Ted Turner did not have, at the time, the collateral for $1 billion loan. He had a business plan. And Michael Milken and the firm of Laissez-Faire's, I think something along those lines, it's defunct now. Lazard Frères, I think it was. It was around for a long time, but it's gone now. But anyway, he put together investors and came up with $1 billion, and CNN became capitalized. And they took on the ABC, CBS, NBC, the major networks, and made major political enemies from them, the networks and the investors, the major investors in those networks. Ted Turner was a success coming out of nowhere, competing with the big television networks. The same man, Michael Milken, capitalized MCI, the telephone company, which busted the long-distance monopoly that AT&T had by law. It was given a government monopoly in each of the states in the U.S. For decades and decades, and long-distance phone service. But MCI came along, funded, capitalized by Michael Milken, and they busted up that monopoly. And so the idea that capital requirements are a serious barrier to entry is refuted by example after example after example in history. If you have a good product, a good service, or even a good business plan that can persuade investors, then the capital markets will come to you. They'll compete to give you the capital. We've seen it time and time and time again. And so that's not really a serious argument for monopoly or barriers to entry. And for many years, and this comes from Karl Marx, there's a theory bandied about that mergers will eventually lead to one big cartel, if not one big company in the world. That idea came from Karl Marx, but it was adopted by a lot of non-Marxians. I think in the last class somebody asked me about this. And of course, just from an economic perspective, one thing this ignores is that when a corporation gets big, yes, there are such a thing as economies of scale or declining cost per unit as output expands, but there are also diseconomies of scale. It becomes harder to manage a bigger and bigger organization, and it becomes harder and harder to manage information when you have tens of thousands of employees, for example. And so we often see inefficiencies created beyond some point, and so we don't have economies of scale forever. And also, from an Austrian perspective, if you did have one big cartel, one big company, there would be an economic calculation problem, because there would be no external markets. There would be no external markets upon which you could price inputs and have a reasonable idea of the scarcity and the relative demands for different inputs. And that's what you need to make genuine profit and loss calculations. And so by definition, with one big cartel and one big monopoly, it wouldn't work. Economic calculation would prohibit it. Economic calculation problem would prohibit it. But when you think about it, the only place in the world where there ever actually has been one big monopoly is under socialism, Karl Marx's system. Where the government laid claim to all property and all industry. So that's where you did have one big monopoly, under socialism, but never under the free market. It's unthinkable. It wouldn't work. We've never seen it in history. It would take massive coercion, of course, to have something like that. And that's why it only has ever occurred in history under socialism. As far as that's concerned, there's not a labor course, but it reminds me of another important point that that Mises made in his book Socialism, that that's the only type of system also that you could really have genuine exploitation of labor, where you have only one employer. Because if you had in the marketplace the exploitation of labor, which we usually define as labor being paid very significantly below its marginal productivity, it creates a profit opportunity for another employer. If I can produce $100 a day for an employer and he pays me a penny a day and pockets $99.99, that creates a profit opportunity for everybody else to offer to pay me, say, a dollar a day. And they still make themselves $99 a day. And then someone will offer me $2 a day and $3 a day. So as long as there's competition in labor markets, you can never have that kind of exploitation. It would require one giant cartel of employers. And in a country like the United States, where there are hundreds of thousands, if not millions of employers, that's unthinkable. But under socialism, it's exactly what happened. The exploitation of everybody as an employee by the government. And so, and that's similar to this point on monopoly that Rothbard makes. Now, there's a lot here about monopoly price. And I'm certainly not going to go over everything Rothbard wrote there. He gets into some pretty technical things, but some of the essential points here about monopoly price. The idea behind the language of monopoly price is that all the textbooks say this. By the way, the economics textbooks, that when they have a chapter on competition, they'll say competitive firms are price takers. They just take the price as given, which in itself is not really true. A lot of firms have latitude to change their price when there's fierce competition. For example, it's very common for new businesses, like the new pizza joint in town, to price below cost for a couple of weeks just to lure people in to try out their pizza, even though they might have 50 competitors within a 20-minute walk in a city. How are you going to get people in the door? Well, you lure them in with low prices, an eye-popping deal for a week or two anyway. And so, there are a lot of reasons why firms alter their prices and have a latitude over their prices, even though they have lots of competition, dozens or hundreds of competitors. So even that is not right. Then when you get to the chapter on monopoly, it says monopolies are price searchers. That is, they can set the price, and they search for the profit-maximizing price. Well, of course, everyone does that. You and I would do that. Everybody wants the best price possible for whatever it is they're selling. That's human nature. That's what we all do. But one big thing this ignores about economics is that all prices in a market are set by voluntary negotiation by buyers and sellers. It's not just the sellers. The monopolist, if you are a monopolist, you can set any price you want, but the buyers don't have to buy it. They can they can always go elsewhere. If you're selling, if you're the only person who rents vacation homes in the island of St. John in the Virgin Islands, you're a monopolist in the rental business of vacation homes. I don't have to go on vacation in the Virgin Islands. I don't have to go on vacation at all. I can save the money and use it for retirement. Or I can blow it at home. And so prices are determined by the voluntary negotiation between buyers and sellers. And the whole notion that monopolists set prices, there used to be a big literature in economics called on administered pricing, about firms that administer the prices. But it ignores the reality of how prices in the marketplace are set. And Rothbard was really right about that. Another thing that Rothbard touches on the economics of competition and monopoly, and Hayek does not, he mentions the issue of brand name, and there's a lot of literature in economics for years calling brand name a barrier to competition, a barrier to entry. If you want to shop for a washing machine, Sears has a certain brand name, and supposedly that cut as a barrier to competition from some newer companies that don't have the brand name. But Rothbard rightly points out that this gets it all backwards. The brand name comes from consumer demand for the product. It does not generate additional consumer demand. It is a result of consumer demand. It's a result of many years of producing good products and good service for the products. That's how you get a brand name. And so, but the brand name itself doesn't just pop out of advertising and therefore gives you all these customers. It's the repeat business that gives you the brand name and the word of mouth from satisfied customers. And so when a company that has a brand name, it's a sign that it's a good competitor. And if it has a better reputation than somebody else, well, markets are dynamic. Markets are ongoing. They're ever changing. And Sears did not always have a brand name. There are a lot of companies that build brand names. Microsoft did not always have a brand name. They eclipsed IBM and a lot of other companies, and now they have their brand name. And other companies will come along and take a lot of business, and they have taken a lot of business in a lot of software products and elsewhere from Microsoft. That's why Bill Gates and the rest at Microsoft have always spent several billion a year in research and development. They know if they don't do that, they will be eclipsed by somebody else, regardless of their brand name. These discussions of Rothbard about these barriers to entry remind me of one of my favorite mainstream articles. Those of you who are really into this, maybe if you have a graduate student or two, there was an article by Harold Demsetz. His name is spelled D-E-M-S-E-T-Z. It was in the American Economic Review, I think 1982. I don't know if it's online or not. Called Barriers to Entry. It was a very Austrian article. And in fact, in rereading this chapter for tonight, gave me the idea of writing an article myself for an academic journal on Rothbard and Demsetz on barriers to entry, because a lot of what Demsetz said in 1982, Rothbard said in the 1960s. And although there are some differences, I met Harold Demsetz. I'm sure he didn't plagiarize anything here, but I think what happened here is Demsetz, a lot of the work he did was very, very similar to the Austrian view of competition as an ongoing dynamic process of rivalry. And he produced some really great literature in economics when he was in his heyday in the 1970s and 80s. He was a UCLA economist. And he never called himself an Austrian, but I always thought that his best work was very Austrian in spirit. And this is one of them, his article, Barriers to Entry. Okay. And of course, the Austrian position is that it only makes sense to think of monopoly as being caused by government, a grant of government. For hundreds of years, the British common law only recognized grants by government as a source of monopoly. And there are a couple of good quotes in this chapter by Rothbard on that. It's a relatively new phenomenon to think of monopoly as somehow being a free market phenomenon. And there's a long history of monopoly being created by the government. Quite often what has happened in American history is companies will try to form a private cartel. And it won't work. It never does. Cheating always seeps in. And even if it did, as Rothbard points out, even if you did succeed in creating a cartel and pushing up the price, that provides an instant incentive for consumers to start looking elsewhere, which would make the demand curve more elastic, and also for competitors and would-be competitors to find substitute products to put on the market. And so and that's why private cartels always break down. And so what businesses often have done is if they try that, they'll resort next to lobbying the government to create a government regulatory agency to literally make competition illegal. The Interstate Commerce Commission was created in the U.S. in 1887, was meant to regulate the railroads. The first president of this ICC was a railroad president, and sure enough, they regulated the railroads for the benefit of the railroads. Then when trucking came along, they regulated the trucking industry for the benefit of the trucking industry at the expense of the consumers, when the Civil Aeronautics Board was created, it regulated the airline industry for the benefit of the airlines and created monopoly pricing. In fact, price competition was illegal for over 50 years in the United States in the airline industry. It was illegal to cut your price. The government set prices of airlines until they were deregulated in the late 1970s. So there's a very long history of this. And antitrust regulation, I would argue also, and we're going to talk about this for the next couple of weeks, has always been a source of monopoly, because it always has been used, not in every single instance, but it always has been used primarily, I would argue, in most instances, in most cases, to protect competitors from competition rather than to protect consumers from monopoly and high prices, which is the ostensible purpose, which is the stated purpose by the economics profession and by the government of it. But in reality, it has always been used to protect competitors from competitions, to create monopoly power, in other words, by government intervention. And as we get into the readings for the next several weeks, we'll learn a great deal more about that point as far as that goes. Rothbard also talks about product differentiation, but so does Hayek. And I talked about that last week. And Hayek does a good job of talking about that. I guess the main difference between this, between the Austrians and the so-called mainstream or neoclassical economists is what I mentioned last week was the Nirvana fallacy. Mainstream economists will look at an innovation, the invention of a new product, and they'll say, well, in this monopoly model we have, if we assumed perfect information, which is the assumption of that model, that theory, then many people would have had the idea for the invention at the same time, and therefore, in perfect competition, there would be many firms with the new product. But in reality, only one firm, only one person invented this new product that the consumers seem to like. Therefore, there's an output restriction beyond this utopian ideal of perfect information, where the light bulb went off in 100 people's heads simultaneously. And that, of course, is a good example of the Nirvana fallacy, because when you compare the real world to Nirvana or perfection, well, of course, the real world is always going to be imperfect, or it will fail, market failure. The real, but what product differentiation is really about is the recognition that, one, consumers have very diverse demands and preferences. And there's a lot of literature in marketing that shows that as societies become more affluent, people tend to change their preferences more frequently. So more affluent societies have an even more diverse array of preferences for goods and services. And so when you see a lot of product differentiation, what you see is the market process, the dynamic process of the market led by entrepreneurs trying to match these constantly changing preferences with the products that will accommodate the preferences. And so when you see a lot of product differentiation, it's a sign of an extremely competitive economy, not a monopolistic economy. But the excuse me, but the mainstream model of monopoly has always looked at it in the opposite way, and has caused a lot of mischief in terms of antitrust regulation, as far as that goes. And now a few words about Israel Kirzner. You can read his articles very clearly written, I think. It's a little obtuse in places, but he makes a few of the main points he makes are pretty standard Austrian points. When we think of competition and monopoly and markets, the mainstream economics books almost totally leave out entrepreneurship. I would think most business people would think this is kind of crazy, because the man or woman on the streets, so to speak, recognizes that this is what drives much of the economy is entrepreneurs, but they're just ignored for the most part in most of the textbooks. And Kirzner says one reason is the model of competition and monopoly in the textbooks is a perfect information model. It's assumed that everybody has perfect information, and so there's no need for arbitrage. There's no need for anyone to be alert to to the fact that there are some inputs out there that are cheaper than anyone else knows about, and so that your business can use these inputs now and produce this product and make a higher profit margin than everybody else, that is assumed to already be known by everybody in the models. And so in a world like that, there is no role for entrepreneurs. And of course, the models are equilibrium models. The competitive model and the monopoly model are equilibrium models. And of course, in equilibrium in competition, price is equal to average cost. Whenever the price goes above average cost, the model says, well, the exceptional profits will lure in additional competition, additional firms, and that additional supply that they provide will drive down the price until it's finally in equilibrium and equal to average cost, no more profit. And of course, that also leaves out the entrepreneur, because it's the entrepreneur who is alert to these arbitrage opportunities that lead the markets from one equilibrium to another. And so the combination of equilibrium modeling and perfect information is Kirzner's two main reasons why the mainstream economics just ignores entrepreneurs, even though to a business person it must sound crazy to not even teach about it. But it's only the Austrians who have always had an emphasis on entrepreneurship among all the schools of thought in economics. And some of the points that Kirzner makes, entrepreneurs are always alert to arbitrage opportunities. And it's the recognition also by the Austrians that this equilibrium is a normal state of affairs, not equilibrium. And it's during this state of disequilibrium that the entrepreneur is out there discovering that there are cheaper ways to produce things that no one else has yet recognized, or that there are products that would satisfy consumer wants that no one has yet recognized would satisfy consumer wants. And the successful entrepreneur is the person who is alert to these opportunities and can act on them before someone else does and make money by doing it. But that's how we go from one equilibrium to another. But the normal state of affairs in a marketplace to the Austrians is disequilibrium. It's not equilibrium. And of course, speculation is sort of the classic entrepreneurial activity where an entrepreneur will gather information that'll allow him to decide that, well, next year the price of this product is going to be higher for whatever reason. It might be something as simple as the weather or many other factors. If this person becomes somewhat of an expert in a particular industry and the cycle of the industry over time and makes an educated guess that next year the price will be up, then the speculator buys a futures contract that will deliver to him, several train loads of this product at a certain price today, that it exists today with that product. And then a year from now comes, he gets delivery of the product, but he doesn't actually take it. He sells it at the higher price if he's right. If he's wrong, he's stuck with a couple of train loads of stuff that he paid too much for. But that's sort of the prototypical economics of speculation that Kirzner alludes to, in terms of an entrepreneur who moves markets, and that's what it's about. Now we have a whole course in the Mises Academy by Stefan Kinsella on patents and copyrights, and so I'm not going to say much about that, other than Rothbard believed himself that patents were an infringement on property rights, and therefore we shouldn't have them. And for example, he says, someone who invents something and gets a patent on it and gets a 20-year monopoly, and you might have another person 1,000 miles away who had the exact same invention, who had no idea that you also had the invention, totally independent, that person can't market the invention because you have a monopoly patent. And so that person didn't steal anything from you, didn't rob you, didn't take your property. They just had the same idea that you did. And Rothbard argued that that is unjust to give one person a patent simply because he made it to the U.S. government patent office 5 minutes earlier than you did, and you had independently had the exact same idea. So he's against that. He's for copyright, because copyright violation can be a form of theft, as he says. If I were to write Man, Economy, and State and put my name on it, that would be a form of theft of Murray Rothbard's property or his heir's property, for example. But he was against patents. And also, you know, if your property, he made the argument that if your property is created by your mind and you created an innovation and you get it patented, why should the government protect your property for 20 years? Why shouldn't it be forever? If the role of government is to protect our rights to life, liberty, and property, why just 20 years? Why not forever? And I mean, so he makes a good point there as far as that's concerned. And I guess I'm almost out of time for the lecture, but one other thing I thought I'd mention, you know, there's a lot in here in this big chapter that I put on the syllabus, and I just wanted to touch on some of the main aspects of Rothbard's thinking and some of Kirzner on competition and monopoly, because they supplement the Hayekian model of competition as far as the Austrian school goes. And there are some differences also, as I just said. But Rothbard does include a chapter on labor unions. And one way that a lot of economists look at unions as labor cartels, but they are aided by government. And so private cartels don't work. They always fall apart for a lot of reasons, for the cheating reason for one of them. And also they naturally create incentives for competition to come about and for consumers to leave, to go elsewhere and seek alternatives, which they eventually will. Consumers can be entrepreneurial too. But unions are based on support by government. There are all kinds of government laws that indirectly subsidize or protect unions and allow them to have to do what they do. And so unions are essentially labor cartels who are to be successful. They have to keep out of the market non-union labor. And I'm going to read one passage here from a book by Morgan Reynolds. If you want to read a good free market-oriented book on unions, read Power and Privilege, Labor Unions in America by Morgan Reynolds. Morgan Reynolds was an economics professor at Texas A&M for many years. He was also the chief economist at the U.S. Department of Labor during the first Bush administration. But I forgave him for that. I've known him for many years. And here's what he says in his book about unions. A union's problem is painfully obvious. Organized strikers must shut down the enterprise, close the market to everyone else. Uncooperative workers, union members, disenchanted former strikers and employers, in order to force wages and working conditions above free market rates. If too many individuals defy the strikers, then unionists often resort to force. Unionists ultimately cannot impose non-competitive wage rates unless they can prevent employers from hiring consenting adults on terms that are mutually satisfactory. Unions must actively interfere with freedom of trade and labor markets in order to deliver on their promises. And now how they have done that is a long history of violence and intimidation where governments have often looked the other way in private sector unions in the United States. There are also laws, all kinds of laws that give unions benefits. I don't have time to get to now. But one example of what I mean by violence and intimidation is there's a giant book published by the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania by two professors there named Armand Thieblot, T-H-I-E-B-L-O-T, and Thomas Haggard, H-A-G-G-A-R-D. The book is entitled The Record, Union Violence, The Record and Response by Courts, Legislatures, and the NLRB. The NLRB is a National Labor Relations Board, which regulates labor relations in the U.S., central planning of labor relations. And this was a 540-page book, and it's based on about the history of union violence in America. And it's all based on police records, court records, news accounts, and so forth of union violence. And here's what they say in the opening chapter, that these records are, quote, full of examples of murder, assault with intent to kill, destruction of property, arson, sabotage, mayhem, shooting, stabbing, beating, stoning, dynamiting, intimidating, threatening, in short, physical, verbal, and psychological abuse of every sort. And they've gotten away with it in many, many instances in the U.S. And elsewhere. British unions used to be even more violent than the American unions. And this is all aimed at non-union workers. It's rarely aimed at management. It's always the non, because that's where the competition is. As Morgan Reynolds said, as labor cartels, unions can only push wages above free market prices if they can somehow keep out the competition for their jobs. And so, and that's basically how they do it. And Fiblo and Haggard argue that this violence is an inherent part of labor relations in American history, or the so-called collective bargaining process. And that, by the way, even that collective bargaining, that came about in the 1930s, where the law, the federal law, said that it is illegal, if there's a union, it is illegal to bargain individually. It ordered companies to bargain with a union. You have to bargain with a union. That's why, for example, right now in the U.S., there's a strike, if you will, a lockout by the National Football League owners. So there's a labor dispute. And in the local papers here, I'm in Baltimore, a coach of the Baltimore Ravens football team has one of his players, one of his star players, is doing professional boxing during the off season. He's a professional boxer. And the coach wanted to go see him, watch him box. But according to an article in the newspaper, he's afraid to do that because it's illegal for him to speak a word to this guy. And so if he is seen saying anything, even hello, it could violate federal labor law because there's a labor dispute going on. And so that's just one example of what I mean of how the government came in the 1930s in the U.S. and forced businesses to bargain not with workers but with unions. You know, on behalf of all workers, whether they belong to union or not, there are laws in a lot of states that force everyone to pay union dues, whether you belong to a union or not. A lot of states have laws allowing unions to have a situation where if you have a job, if you want a job, you have to join the union. Otherwise, you can't have the job. And so that's what I'm talking about, just a few examples of these laws that support the labor cartels that are unions. And Rothbard does mention this at the end of this chapter on competition and monopoly as applied to labor markets. And so I see it's 8:25, so that's probably enough of a long-winded lecture for now. Hopefully the video has been on in the audio this whole time. So if you have any questions, I'll be glad to do my best to answer once again. I'll look at the chat and see what I can see. Andreas, is there any scientific support for the authorities when they step in the market and regulate? Well, they use the mainstream economic models. Typically, when there's an antitrust case, they will hire an economist or several economists or an economic consulting firm to come up with a new theory of monopoly. When the U.S. government sued Kellogg's, General Mills, and General Foods, the cereal companies, in the 1970s, they hired an economist, Frederick Scherer, to create a whole new theory of shared monopoly. Even though they weren't a monopoly, there were three different companies. A monopoly is one company, one seller. He invented a brand new theory. The government lost that particular case. The Microsoft antitrust case, the government hired an MIT economist to come up with another brand new theory that involved hundreds and hundreds of equations, as everything that comes out of MIT does, arguing that Microsoft was a monopoly, even though the government itself never even claimed in court that Microsoft had ever harmed consumers. It did not even make that was not even a part of the case that there was consumer harm, even though for over 100 years, the basis of antitrust laws in the U.S. has always supposedly been consumer protection. And so they had to hire an economist to come up with a creative new theory of why Microsoft was evil, even though it did not harm its consumers, because it so obviously benefited its consumers who were voluntarily buying its products after all. And so, yeah, there's a very large part of the economics profession that supports this. Some of it consults on both sides of lawsuits, for and against the lawsuits. There are many economists who work in the government at the Federal Trade Commission, at the Antitrust Division of the Justice Department, and they're the ones who come up with the economic rationales for the lawsuits. And a lot of it is based on market structure studies, has been historically, and they're constantly spinning new theories of wrongdoing in the marketplace. And certainly the neoclassical approach has paved the way because it's static, it's an equilibrium model, but markets are dynamic. And so when you look at any one point in time, if you look at any collection of industries, you're going to see some firms are bound to be some two or three or maybe even one are going to have a big market share because they're simply at that moment doing things better than everybody else is, better product and or cheaper product. But that doesn't last, never lasts. There are many, many studies looking at industries like this over a 10-year, 20-year period, and the top firms always tend to descend toward the median, and the bottom firms ascend up toward the median also. So markets are still very dynamic. Yeah, but if you take a snapshot equilibrium view, which is what the mainstream model does, then, of course, you can always cherry-pick something that looks like above average profits persisting for a few years and call it monopoly. And that's one of the things that is often done. Let's see. They also say that it's difficult, however, to defend a company merger on a free market basis because there is no free market basis, but one where the government invades private property with the redistribution. I'm not sure what this says here. Let's see. Well, I don't know what these opinions are. There are opinions that say that the legislation creates incentives for companies to sow each other. I'm not sure what sow each other is, and to compete with the help of government. Well, the antitrust laws do that. The antitrust laws have always been used as a club against competition. In the U.S., over 90% of all antitrust lawsuits have always been private lawsuits, one company suing another. Not the government suing in the name of the public, but one company suing another. And typically, if the company being sued is monopolistic, what does that mean? That means, according to the neoclassical model, it's raising prices. And so if your competitor is raising prices, why would you sue? You only sue if your competitor is dropping his prices. And so all of these lawsuits of company suing another company, it's typically one company or a few companies figure out how to improve the quality of their product much better than everybody else, or they figured out a way of producing it more cheaply than everybody else. It's almost automatic in a lot of industries that they'll be sued by one of their competitors, and the lawsuits are often very frivolous and are thrown out of court, but they're only meant to force the innovative companies to spend a lot of money and waste a lot of time on lawsuits as opposed to taking care of business and competing better. And so a lot of that does happen. And the antitrust laws themselves are a big tool that is used in that. Okay, sue, not so. Let's see that. Andreas wants books to read on property rights and competition. Well, Murray Rothbard's Murray Rothbard is the one economist who's known to always incorporate property rights into his writings. The economists, the two mainstream economists, Armin Alchin and Harold Demsetz, UCLA economists, who wrote a lot over the years on property rights. From sort of a Chicago school perspective, but a lot of it is very good and consistent with what the Austrians would say. So if you want to do a literature search Look up Armin Alchian, spelled Alchian, and Demsetz, Harold Demsetz. And they've written many articles over the years. There's a book of readings by Alchian that has been published. I think Liberty Fund publishes it. And also, they published a great textbook probably 35 years ago called University Economics. That was great because it was very free market. You have a very thorough understanding of economics if you use this book. It was the first book I used when I began teaching. And they do incorporate property rights analysis into a lot of it, which at the time, 30 years ago, was almost unheard of, except for Murray Rothbard and a few other Austrians. And so that's one place I would look on property rights. And of course, Hans Hermann Hoppe, his writings are very property rights oriented. So take a look at the books written by Hans, and he has a book on private property. So read Hans's book on private property. It's probably online at the Mises Institute. I'm not sure if it's online or not. I know it's for sale. But that's what I would recommend off the top of my head. Let's see. Some will argue that every person has a price. So a monopoly at one point will be able to buy everyone out of the business. how can we disprove that? Well, it has never happened. That should give you pause over this theory that there could be a monopolist who would buy everyone out of an industry. But part of the economics of it is, if someone tried this to buy out all the competition, the act of buying will drive up the price of the businesses, and so you'll have an upward sloping supply curve. You'll be spending more and more and more money trying to buy everybody up, and then once you do that, capital markets are fluid enough so that if you did buy up everybody out of the business, and you say, "Aha, I'm a monopolist. I'm going to charge 10 times more." Competition will flood in from all over the planet. So you won't be able to charge 10 times more. You will have spent every penny you have buying all these businesses, and you probably will be in a situation of where there's no way you could efficiently run all of them. And so it will be an economic catastrophe for anyone to try that, which, of course, is why we have never seen that anywhere in the world. And so So I'm always entertained by these sort of James Bond conspiracy theories of economics, where there's always one big bad guy with a bald head smoking a big cigar who's plotting to buy up the world. If you think about it for 5 or 10 minutes about the likelihood of it from an economic basis, they're usually ridiculous. What do I think of AT&T takeover? Take over by what? Take over by who? Answer that first. Vaughn's Grocery, yeah, that's sort of a classic bad antitrust case. I'll talk about that next week. Next couple of weeks I've devoted to antitrust in particular. And so, and I was actually planning on talking about that. So I don't want to steal my own thunder for what I've already prepared for that. But yeah, that's one of many of the sort of notoriously bad cases that people talk about, antitrust economists talk about as a bad example. Yeah, The Ethics and Economics of Property is the name of Hans Hoppe's book. And yeah, it's available online, so I would recommend that one for sure. The book from Wharton is Union Violence, and then the subtitle is The Record and the Response by the Courts, Legislatures, and the NLRB. And the authors are Armand, A-R-M-A-N-D, last name is Tiblot, T-H-I-E-B-L-O-T, and the co-author is Thomas Haggard, H-A-G-G-A-R-D. That's the Union book. The other book was Power and Privilege by Morgan Reynolds. And Morgan Reynolds has presented papers at the Mises Institute. I think he's on the board of editors or board of contributors to the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics. He's retired now, but he's been a fellow traveler of the Austrian school for many years. buy everyone out. It would not be possible without government help. Well, yeah, in theory, if you would pick some industry and buying everyone out could be another word for nationalization. If the government were to nationalize the healthcare industry, well, that's a way of buying everyone out, isn't it? Except they're not buying. They're just dictating and taking over. And so, nationalization or socialism is the only way you've ever had one person in control of an entire industry. That's called nationalization. And so if you have people who make up these James Bond conspiracy theories of economics with one, big fat bald guy holding two big bags of money out here and while smoking a big giant cigar plotting to buy everyone out, well, that is absurd and ridiculous, but it happens all the time in history when the government nationalizes industries. That's who to worry about. If you want to worry about the creation of a single monopoly in an industry, it's always been government. And the people who make these James Bond conspiracy theories are usually statists who invent them as a way of sort of, in their feeble-minded way, smearing capitalism. Do I have any comments on the NFL situation? I wish they would figure out how to split that $9 billion before football season starts. The whole thing sounds silly to me. I mean, it's called an antitrust suit, but I don't see any antitrust issues there. There's a lot of competition. They make most of their money selling merchandise and on television. There are lots of substitutes for that merchandise. You don't have to buy the $85 football shirt with Drew Brees' name on it. You could use that $85 to buy beer. Beer is a substitute for football shirts with Drew Brees' name on the back, as far as that's concerned. And the same goes for television. You don't have to devote your time to watch the television and buy the products that are advertised on the football games. So there are lots of substitutes. So I don't see a monopoly issue here at all, even though they apparently filed an antitrust lawsuit of some kind. I haven't read the lawsuit, so I don't even know what the charges are on the NFL. AT&T buying T-Mobile. The state attorneys general, that's who supposedly polices monopoly at the state level. At the federal level in the U.S., you've got the Federal Trade Commission and the Antitrust Division of the U.S. Justice Department. And at the state level, it's state attorneys general. And so the state attorneys general are all wannabe governors. They all want to be governor and then eventually president someday. And so they all want to make a name for themselves as protecting the consumer. And so whenever you have a big company like AT&T wanting to buy anything, they will almost automatically investigate because it's easy to fool Joe and Jane Sixpack into thinking big bad AT&T is going to rip them off somehow. But there are a lot of mobile phone companies out there, and there are a lot of potential competitors out there. And so typically when you see a merger like this, it'll be a company like AT&T that thinks it has a soft spot in its business organization, and that a company like T-Mobile can fill it up, can improve their competitiveness, because they do compete with a lot of companies around the world now. It wasn't always true. It was a state-run monopoly for many years, a state-regulated monopoly for many, many years. And so there are almost inevitably efficiency reasons for these types of acquisitions and mergers. And there's just too much competition out there to think that there would be they could somehow capture the phone market by purchasing this one company. When there are competition out there. See, Kurzner referred to Joseph Schumpeter a few times. Is he still used as an authority and referred to by modern mainstream economists? He is, but only as a footnote. Mainstream economists don't really talk much about entrepreneurship, and Schumpeter did. He died in 1950. And he's mentioned in all the textbooks by name, and there are a few economists I know that are actually the ones that are sort of Austrian friendly, fellow travelers that write, that are sort of professors in business schools in places like Silicon Valley, maybe UC Berkeley, someplace like that, whose research agenda is innovation and entrepreneurship. They'll cite Schumpeter, or they'll title some of their papers a Schumpeterian theory of something like that. But it's a very minor part of mainstream economics, and Kirzner just contrasts his theories, the Austrian theory of entrepreneurship, to Schumpeter's, which are really kind of in a way opposites. The Austrian theory says that the entrepreneur is what moves markets to equilibrium. Schumpeter said that entrepreneurs are disruptive. They disrupt equilibrium and equilibria and move the markets away from it. And so that's one difference. But there's some research on Schumpeter, but not much. Probably his most famous book is Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy. And so it wasn't just about entrepreneurship and innovation and inventions. It was on democracy and socialism and a lot of other things. And he was a very wise man. I would recommend that book. If you have a number of classic books in economics to read, that would certainly be one of them. Schumpeter's Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy. What's the criteria that would make the government not allow companies to merge? The government uses different criteria all the time on merger guidelines. And there are U.S. Department of Justice merger guidelines that tell companies what they're supposed to do if they want to merge. And also, and they change all the time. They revise them all the time. And so you never know what the law is if it can be changed all the time, which is a bad thing. It's sort of a breakdown of the rule of law. But for many, many years, they use arbitrary market share numbers, concentration ratios. And if your concentration ratio in the industry, say the four-firm concentration ratio, which is the percentage of sales by the four largest firms in a single industry, if it got up to around 60%, then that would be a red flag. Buzzers would buzz. The alarm bell would go off, and you better start sweating it, because the Justice Department is probably going to sue you for violating the antitrust laws in some way by the mere fact that you have 60% market share. That's what happened to Kellogg's General Foods and General Mills in the 1970s. And of course, Microsoft, since they said to have had 90% market share in operating systems, not 100. That's what a monopoly would be. Apple did exist, and so did some other operating systems. And that was one of the main things that was cited over and over and over again. But it's sort of numbers like this. Government planners, central planners, that's why they have economic statistics. That's why they create all these economic statistics. They want to use them to centrally plan the economy. And in the area of antitrust, they use these concentration ratio statistics. They have been for many years. They've been critiqued over and over and over again because they don't take into consideration international competition. They don't take into consideration potential competition. They don't take into consideration how you got the big market share. Did you get it because you produce great products at low prices? Looking at that statistic doesn't tell you that. It just tells you they have a big market share. And so that's what they often do. They use those criteria. They still do. And of course, a lot of what goes on is political. A merger will be proposed by two companies, and a competing company, a third company, will realize that the merger of these two companies will create a much more efficient company that will produce this product at a much lower cost than me. So I will go to my senator and get my senator to get the Federal Trade Commission to launch an investigation of this merger and hopefully hold it up because it'll harm me, because this new company will be lower priced than mine. That happens all the time. There's a book called a book of readings called The Political Economy of Antitrust, edited by William Shugart, spelled Shugart, and Fred McChesney. And I have an article in it, and several of the articles in it are sort of a public choice or a political economy approach to antitrust, showing the extent to which politics comes into play when you're talking about why the government stops certain mergers. There's one article in particular by Robert Tollison and William Shugart called Antitrust Pork Barrel, where they argue that to a very large extent, antitrust regulation is a sort of pork barrel politics of the sort I just explained, where two companies will merge and they will obviously make them more efficient, more competitive. So the third company will get Congress. It's people that it influences through its campaign contributions in Congress to stop the merger. So that's a way of Congress handing out a benefit to a company that is located in the state of the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, let's say. And that company, in return, will give hundreds of thousands of dollars to that person's campaign and that person's party, whether it's a Democrat Party or the Republican Party. And that's how it sometimes works. That's what motivates a lot of these cases where mergers are stopped. There's always a political rat involved. So they don't always use science, believe it or not. Politicians don't always use science to decide these things. Politics comes into play. But I think the Hayek's view can be considered a purely Austrian one. Well, he was an Austrian, so sure. His Hayek's essay, The Meaning of Competition, really I consider to be a classic statement of the Austrian view of competition. It really is. And Rothbard makes a few additions there, but Rothbard would go along with that article too. He would cite it and think it's a very well done article. See, do I agree with Rothbard's assertion that the government protecting brand names and trademarks is legitimate and doesn't constitute a grant of privilege? I don't know if he says the government should protect brand names. How would the government protect a brand name? I don't think he says that as far as brand names. I mean, if I have a reputation, DiLorenzo's golf clubs or some product that I make, I don't think the government could protect that in any way. Other than copyright in terms of published things about my company. Let's see. And brand names and trademarks. Well, no, and patents. He's against patents, but he's for copyrights, because the rule that Rothbard used is, if you think something constitutes an act of theft, then it should be disallowed. And so whenever he talks about all these things, that's his argument. That's his argument. If it's an act of theft, should be disallowed. And if the government is going to enforce the act of theft, that would be a bad thing. Okay, I guess we're going to need to wrap up. We need to use Danny's services for another lecture. But thank you all for participating. I enjoy talking about these things that I've been studying for 30 years, and I like the idea that I can impart this to people who are really interested in learning these things, and we'll have fun the next few weeks in a very detailed discussion of antitrust and its applications. And have a good night, and good luck to Danny with the next class.